Hi, everyone. My name is Lynn Sterley Schofield. I'm a member of the Department of Mathematics and Statistics, and I'm here to talk to you today about our Commonwealth's high-stakes testing system. So what I want to sort of do is use a project that I've been working on that's looking at sort of educational policy as a way to think about sort of what is statistics, why is it important, how does it sort of broadly cover lots of different disciplines. So I'm going to use this particular example as a way to answer some questions about what do statisticians do, what do we like, what do we find fun as a way to do this. So I'll start essentially by just sort of first acknowledging a couple of other people who've been working on this project with me. Frank Grossman and I have a paper that's under review right now about this work, and we've worked with a couple of students who've since graduated, Emily, Gina, and Simone. So I'll start by just telling you a little bit about sort of the particular policy that I'm going to talk about, and then we'll get into sort of how I've used statistics to study this particular thing. So those of you that have children who are sort of high school age will know that in January 2010, the Commonwealth's Board of Education approved changes to the state's graduation requirements. And the big changes that they made required students to pass six what they call end-of-course exams. And these are replacing what were previously known as the PSSAs, which students had to pass. So the PSSAs were tests that were done in mathematics, reading, writing, and sort of a general science test. These new end-of-course exams are specific to a course that you take. So if I am a senior and I take a biology test, then I take an end-of-course exam in biology, not sort of the general science PSSA test now. And part of Pennsylvania law states that whenever a state agency changes any of the sort of rules and regulations, they have to garner public opinion about these changes that they make, and then they have to make all of the public opinion that they garner public. So it makes it sort of an interesting thing that those of us who are interested in this can actually study. This change in Pennsylvania, though, is just sort of one example of sort of a larger shift in educational policy that's occurring, where our educational policy is sort of being more centralized at the state level. So previously, sort of local districts could make decisions, they could make policies that they want, and then they would go forth and do whatever they wanted. But now, sort of more and more, particularly over the last decade or two, states are sort of stepping in and making statewide policies. So there's sort of two schools of thought about this centralization of educational policy. So some see this as a huge benefit because they believe that what this essentially does is sort of equalize or sort of increase equity across sort of educational policy and educational inputs, outputs, and outcomes. And so sort of an easy example of sort of a place where there was a huge benefit to centralization was in educational finance, right? So if we compare sort of the revenue sources between Wallingford Swarthmore School District, where most of us live, and Chester Upland, right down the road, where some of us live as well, you'll see that the revenue for Wallingford Swarthmore, almost 85% of it comes from local sources, right? We have a strong tax base here in Wallingford Swarthmore. We're able to sort of afford to give lots of local taxes that goes to support our educational schools. Whereas in Chester Upland, they have a much smaller tax base. And so, in fact, your state taxes, if you live here in Wallingford Swarthmore, do go in some part to support the Wallingford Swarthmore schools, but they go in even larger part to support Chester, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Allentown, some of the places. And the idea here is that by sort of equalizing this, we've now equalized the revenue sources into the districts, meaning that now when we look at things, as opposed to, say, two decades ago, we have approximately the same amount of expenditures per students in sort of poorer urban and poorer rural districts versus the sort of richer suburban districts. So here's one place where centralization would probably be considered a particularly good thing. It's equalized what we've got here. There are some, though, who sort of claim that there's a huge disadvantage to centralization, right? That the idea here is that if we have a one-size-fits-all policy across how we do educational work, then, in fact, that leads to less experimentation and less diversity. And certainly those of us who are faculty here in the room probably would argue that we don't want anyone sort of making a broad educational policy to tell us what we should do in our classroom. So curricular decisions are a particular place where people have argued against some of these centralization and saying that, in fact, we would want communities to be able to take in local customs, local cultures, whatever sort of the expertise of particular teachers are, to be able to do this. So what you see with centralization is that you have sort of this balancing system that you're trying to do, where you're trying to both equalize things or sort of increase equity, but at the same time not decrease efficiency and experimentation too much by sort of centralizing these decisions. So the question that we, my colleagues and I, have sort of been asking is what centralization might mean for political participation. So we could argue that it's probably pretty likely that by centralizing decisions, we're in fact sort of decreasing efficiency in people being able to voluntarily participate in the decision-making that occurs. So here's a really easy example. Carr Everbach, who's sitting here, was recently on the Wallingford Swarthmore School Board. Carr lives 3 houses away from me. So if there was ever a time when the school board was making a decision and I didn't like it, I could literally walk down the street, knock on his door, and say, Carr, what are you doing? This is a ridiculous idea. Or, hey, Carr, can you give me a little bit more information about this? Now that these decisions are being centralized, even if my state representative lives on my street, which he or she does not, he or she also has to take into account the fact that these congressional districts actually cross many school districts. And so instead of just being able to take into account me, they also have to be able to take into account all of the other school districts that they represent. And so we could see that this sort of centralization in the sense of political participation clearly actually does sort of decrease, you could argue, efficiency. So we want to ask the question, is it actually increasing equity when we do this at the same way in political participation? So why do we even care whether or not we have equity across political participation? Well, political scientists, I don't know if there's any in the room, but political scientists have sort of studied this, and what they've noticed is that individuals participate quite differentially across almost any demographic variable that you can come up with. So the most obvious place where people sort of participate differentially is in voting, right? And what we see is that those who, on average, tend to be white, male, high socioeconomic status, and high education levels are much more likely to vote than those who are not. That's not to say that that's, but sort of on average what you see. This is even, these differentials become even larger when you look at things like voluntary participation, things like signing petitions, giving money to sort of local political action groups, participating in town hall meetings. You see even larger differentials. What you also see is that if you actually dig much deeper, that if you look across groups, even where groups agree that they both disagree with a particular policy, they actually have very different reasons between different groups for sort of being against a particular policy. So men might be against one policy for very different reasons than women might be against a particular policy. So why do we care about this? Well, because participation actually matters in both the design and the implementation of our policies. What we note is that policymakers actually listen differentially as well to individuals depending on what groups. And Bartels in particular noted that policymakers tend to listen more to their constituents who are from higher socioeconomic statuses than those who are from lower socioeconomic statuses. And so if, in fact, we have this differential participation, we have people who have sort of different opinions about the modifications and changes to policies that we might have, and we have policymakers listening differentially, we want to understand, are people actually participating differentially? Are we making it easier for people to participate, or are we setting up more barriers as a result? So what is our data in order to try to answer sort of this broader question of who's participating and what do they think? Because, as I mentioned, Pennsylvania law states that every single solitary one of our of the public opinion had to be made public. We have every single solitary piece of material that was stated responding to these proposed graduation policy changes. So that means we have every testimony, every email, every letter, every petition that was done, giving us a little over 1,500 documents. And by documents, I mean sort of a petition, a email, a testimony, and over 3,000 signatures. So why do we have differences between the documents and the signatures? Well, there are some documents that are multi-signature documents, right? So a petition could say be one document, but could account for 250 signatures. Whereas a letter might be one document and also be one signature that we have in particular. So the characteristics, or what statisticians would call the variables, that we've noted for each of these documents is the position that the individual stated for the policy, either I am for this policy, I'm against this policy. We've coded the reasons that they are either for or against in order to actually look to see whether or not individuals from different groups have different policy changes they would like to make. The number of actors who sign the source, and because individuals, when they sign such things, tend to give addresses, we were able to also match almost everybody to a school district that they lived or they worked in. And then the actor type, so whether or not they self-identified as a school board member, a superintendent, an employee other than the superintendent, a parent, and if they didn't self-identify, we kind of called them a citizen. So our research question, or at least the one that I'm going to focus on for today, because we don't have enough time to do all of the research questions, are who takes a public stand for or against these state assessment policies, and how representation might differ within and between school districts and these actor types. A lot of you are probably saying, wait, I thought this was supposed to be the second Tuesday science cafe, right? This seems like a political science question and not necessarily a science question. And so you might also say, why does a statistician care about something like that? And so to answer that question, we have to sort of step back for a second and ask ourselves, what is the discipline of statistics really ultimately about? And I see the discipline of statistics as essentially being the study of data. Okay? Statisticians, what we want to know about is sort of how individuals collect, how we organize, how we analyze, how we interpret, and ultimately how we present data, and how the collection, organization, analysis, and presentation affects our interpretation of the results. So we study very broadly data, which means I might argue, some people might disagree, that the discipline of statistics is the most interdisciplinary discipline that you could possibly have. Because any single solitary discipline that involves data means that on some level you're involving some statistical guidelines or policies or theorems that are involved in that. So why do we study data? Well, essentially because what we're trying to do is be able to explain variation that exists. Right? So in this case, I'm trying to explain the variation of who participated, what different people thought about how they participated. In the case of Amy's talk last month, she's sort of studying the variation in, if two people are exposed to the same virus, why does one get sick and the other doesn't? But underneath her study is some level of statistical analysis that she had to do in order to do this. And in some sense, one could argue that as a statistician who's interested in sort of policy issues, I come by this very honestly, because the etymology of the word statistics, the stat part of statistics, actually comes from a political German scientist, or a German political scientist, who sort of first defined statistics as being the science of dealing with data about the condition of a state or community. So that stat comes from the state, from the word state. Now, we've broadened this definition of statistics to now essentially being the science of dealing with data, not just about political states, but about biological states, about physical states, about chemical states, about sociological states, right? It's a broader definition. So what I'd like to do for the remainder of the talk is sort of think about how we've collected our data, how we've organized our data, how we've analyzed this data, in fact, does affect the interpretation of the data, and in so doing, sort of provide a couple very broad guidelines. These are not all of the guidelines one needs to think about as a statistician, but a couple of those, and use this particular sort of ed policy as an example, sort of a point. Okay, so the first one we want to look at is sort of how we collect data. What are the kinds of questions that statisticians have to ask in the collection of data, and how does the collection of data actually affect how we might interpret our results? Okay, so sort of the first question that most statisticians will ask when they're thinking about collecting data is, what population does my sample belong to? Now, we could argue in this case that the population that the sample of this data, right, this data is a bunch of petitions, it's a bunch of letters, it's a bunch of documents, it's a bunch of signatures. So it belongs to the larger population of all of the possible documents and all of the possible signatures that could have been written by citizens of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And that what we have is just one sample of the ones that were written. So the next question we might want to ask is our sample representative of all the citizens in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania? What do you guys think? No. Who are we missing?
People who don't care.
People who don't care, right? So what we have in this case, whenever our sample is not representative we're going to have some form of bias in the collection of our data. And that can then bias the interpretation of our results. Now, in this particular case, as Eric pointed out, we have something that statisticians call a self-selection bias, right? And this is when individuals select themselves into a particular group, and that sort of selection going into the group can cause a biased sample, right? So if we sort of have two different things, what we would want would be sort of every one of those dots might be sort of a random citizen or a random signature or a random document out of the entire population of Pennsylvania. We want that to be a random group of people so that we could be able to say something broadly about what do citizens in Pennsylvania believe about this new graduation requirement. What we have is more of a black hole, right, of all of those who chose to write in. And we know nothing about all of these sort of citizens here in the blue. Now, when it matters to have this self-selection bias is when the choice to self-select into a certain group also affects the outcome that we're looking at, right? That's when it matters. That's why statisticians like to have randomness. Because if we have randomness, then we know that the choice of you being in that sample is not at all affected by any characteristic that might also affect your possible outcome of what you think. But in this case, we believe that those who wrote in probably care an awful lot. So what we have are sort of the two extremes, those who really hated this new policy and those who really loved it, right? We don't know anything about the people in the middle. What we also probably don't know very much about, what we probably also have, are a lot more citizens who sort of don't feel disenfranchised, right? Who feel as though their voice is something that politicians and policymakers are going to want to listen to. So we have, within those who wrote in, those who think, my voice actually matters. I should write in. And I have sort of a certain amount of political and economic capital that I can use to write in and make my voice known. Meaning that among these in this group as well are those who may have a very strong opinion about the policy, but have neither the economic nor political capital to choose to write in as well. So, in other words, because we've collected the data in the way that we have, because we've used the data that's available to us of those who chose to write in, the interpretation of our results, we have to be very careful then to say that any results that we come up with can only be about those who chose to write in. We don't know anything about these blue people. All we know stuff about are the black. And so how we collect the data matters for how we interpret the results of things. So I point this out just for those people who are sort of in the room. The thing that statisticians hate more than anything is when people have already done the whole experiment and then they come to us and they say, here's my data, help me analyze it. And we say, but wait a second. As a statistician, we needed to be involved at the very beginning. How did you collect the data? How did you choose your sample? Who's in this sample? What individuals are there? And what do we need to know about those individuals? Okay, so the second part, sort of the second sort of broad issue, is how do we organize this data, right? So we've got a lot of data, right? We have all these petitions, and it's pretty hard to sort of interpret them if all I'm looking at is every petition and every email, all of these things individually. And so one question that we often have to ask ourselves is sort of what should the unit of analysis be? In other words, what should be sort of the basis about which I'm doing this? Should I be looking at this analysis at a per signature level? Or should I be looking at this analysis at a per document level? And in fact, whether I do things at a per document or a per signature level can matter, right? So let's think sort of broadly why this matters, and then I'll give you a specific example. If I'm looking at things at a signature level, then ultimately the questions that I'm asking are about sort of who participated, and I'm counting whether you signed a petition or whether you wrote an individual letter as being equal. That's the unit part of unit of analysis, right? Everything counts as one. So if you signed a petition and you wrote a letter, and I'm saying those two things are equal, policymakers might not agree with that, right? Policymakers might say, I'm going to count this letter as more because it takes more effort for you to sit down and write a particular letter by yourself. So I should count that letter more than I should count some random person who got stopped at the local Acme and signed the thing just to get the person off their back. If I count things at the document level, though, then essentially I'm saying that every document counts the same. So I'm saying that then a policymaker is saying, I believe that a petition that has 500 signatures should count the same as a petition that has 50 signatures. And that might not also be true, right? It could be that as a policymaker I'm saying, wow, 500 people think this is a really bad idea or think this is a great idea. That's a whole lot more than thinking about 50 people thinking this versus 50 people. 500 versus 50. This is a very different kind of level about where we do. Now, the question of whether the unit of analysis should be signature or document is actually not one that I, as a statistician, can particularly answer in this case, right? I don't actually know how policymakers count things. I don't know, and I would imagine that different policymakers count things very differently depending on what policy they want to put forward or not. But what is important is to recognize that I might get different results depending on whether I do things at a signature or a document unit of analysis. And so in some sense, the choice that we've made is to analyze everything both by signature and by document, look to see where are things the same in the results that we get, and where are they different in order to understand how sort of the unit of analysis can affect things. So let me show you sort of one particular case where how we count things can matter quite a bit. So what we have here is sort of bar charts, which is showing the percentage of signatures and or documents by the different actor types, whether they're superintendent, school board, employee, parent, or citizen. So the gray, the dark red, and the dark green are the signature ones, and the white, the pink, and the light green are the document ones. Okay? So the red and the pink are the people who are against, right? They're saying stop the policy, that's why they're red. And the green ones are, woohoo, this is a great idea, let's go forward with it. Okay, so we're going forward. So what you see is if you look here at the total, we see that regardless of whether I count things by signatures or documents, about 85 to 90% of signatures and documents were against the policy. And only about 10 to 15% of individuals wrote in favor of it. That probably makes sense, right? Very rarely do we write our local representatives and say, way to go, you did a really good job, right? We usually say, oh my gosh, you're doing horribly. Where this is interesting, though, is to look at the comparison of signatures and documents, is to look at the comparison between school boards and look at parents. If we look at the signatures, right, these are the dark ones, what we notice is that about 30% of signatures are from parents, and only about 15% or so are from school board members. So if what I'm trying to talk about is sort of who participated, if I look at the signature level analysis, what I'm saying is parents participate more than school board members do. I see the opposite actually happening if I look at the document level analysis, right? Because there, I only have about 18% or so of parents participating, and I have about 22, 23, 25% of school board members participating. Or I'm sorry, not of school board members, but 25% of the documents are from school board members. So there I might say, wow, school board members are participating more than parents. Anybody know why we see these differences? Well, school board members and parents both do have vested interests, but why am I seeing a difference between the signature level analysis and the document level analysis? Parents are a lot more likely to sign petitions. So what we end up seeing is that parents, out of all of these different groups, are much more likely to be on what we call multiple signature documents. They're much more likely to sort of sign petitions or get together with their husband or wife and say, we both disagree with this. They're much more likely to get together with the PTO and say, we, the undersigned of the PTO, think this is a horrible idea. School board members are much more likely to write in and say, I'm a school board member, I know what I'm talking about, and I either think this is a good or this is a bad policy. And so whether or not we analyze this by these two things gives us very different interpretations. But doing the analysis at both levels actually gets us to this subtle difference in how people are participating, not just whether they're participating, which is kind of cool and interesting. We can similarly look at sort of the differences by district of how people participated. And so here what we have are box plots. So what these are is the sort of bottom line is the first quartile or the 25th percentile. The middle line right here is the median. And then the top line here of the box is the third quartile or the 75th percentile. And all of these are sort of outliers, groups that are a little bit different. So what this is looking at is the number of signatures per district of sort of who was for and who was against the policy. And so overall, if you look at the total again, we see that sort of on average, districts sent in about 2 signatures total. Although we have a couple of districts who sent in 682 and 418, right? So these are districts that really got together and did some major petitions as they went through things. What we look at, though, is if we look here, is what we see is that on average, high-performing districts, those are the districts that were in the top 50 of those PSSAs, the previous state exams that I talked about, participate much more so than do sort of the mid-performing districts, which are those that did well enough to kind of pass but aren't in the top 50, and those that are called no AYP, or didn't make adequate yearly progress, which is the way the federal government defines by No Child Left Behind, you sort of failing or not failing. These are based on sort of these state-level tests. So you can sort of think of these as being the kids who did really well on the tests. These are the kids that did decently well, and these are the sort of school districts that did particularly poorly on these tests. And so what we see is that high-performing districts participate a lot, and it looks like they're pretty much against the policy, quite a bit so. If we look, though, we actually see that those districts that did not make AYP actually participate more than the districts that are sort of in the middle, which is interesting, because that's not what political scientists would have necessarily said, right? They said that people participate differentially, and that those who are more disenfranchised tend to participate less. But we see something a little different. Those groups that are sort of from districts where you see a lot more disenfranchised students, you tend to see actually slightly more participation than you do in the mid-performing groups. And similarly, we see that sort of those districts that have high groups of URMs, which are underrepresented minorities, versus low, we see that we don't see that big of a difference between these two. So this is if we look at things by signature. We see something a little bit different when we look at things by document, again. So what we notice is, again, yes, we see that high-performing districts participate much more so than anybody else. But what you'll notice is that the only district type that has one of these green boxes are those that are not AYP, that didn't make adequate yearly progress. So essentially what this is telling us is that if the districts are high-performing, mid-performing, have high underrepresented minorities or low-represented minorities, they're pretty much against the policy. But that those that didn't make AYP, they're giving some documents that are against the policy and some documents that are for the policy. So high-performing districts are uniformly pretty much against it. You're seeing almost every document is saying, this is awful. Whereas in the non-AYP, you're seeing that some of those districts are saying, we think this is good, some are saying we think this is bad, and some are sending in documents that are saying both. They're saying, some of the documents say, I think this is a bad idea, and some of the documents say, I think this is a good idea. But it's only by analyzing this both by document and by signature that we're able to see these differences that occur. And so again, if we think back to sort of the statistical issues that we have here, the unit of analysis gives us a very different interpretation of the data that we have, depending on what's going on. So I could make these box plots and these bar charts a little bit more formal by doing something which is called a logistic regression. And I want to sort of explain this, and then I'll show some pictures of what this is. So what's this thing over here on the side? So P of con I over P of pro I is essentially saying the probability that a particular signature is against the policy over the probability that the particular signature is for the policy. So another way to think about that is to say these are the odds. It's the odds that a signature is for or against. The same kind of odds when you play the lottery, right? You have a 1 in 4 chance. So one time you're going to win, 4 times you're going to lose if you play 5 times. We take the log for sort of mathematical reasons, which I'm not going to go into, but ultimately what I'm looking at there is trying to sort of predict the odds. And I'm trying to predict that, in this case, based on whether the individual is a superintendent, a school board member, an employee, or a parent. So what statisticians do is we try to estimate what these betas are going to be, the beta 0, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, beta 4. Because what that's going to tell me is whether changing from being a non-superintendent to a superintendent changes my odds. Okay, so let's look at a picture of what this might look like. Okay, so essentially, if I look at a particular signature, it can fall into one of 4 categories. It could be from a non-superintendent and against the policy, could be from a non-superintendent and for the policy. It could be a superintendent against or a superintendent for the policy. Right? These are sort of the four different things. And what you'll see is if you look sort of at the columns, those that are non-superintendent are weighted a lot higher at being against the policy. So if I take a big bowl and I put all of the signatures that are from non-superintendents in that bowl, the odds that I'm going to pick something against the policy are much higher because I've got a lot more con signatures than I do pro signatures. Whereas if I take that big bowl and instead put all of the signatures that are superintendents, what I see is that sort of they're weighted kind of equally. It's almost like a 50-50 chance as to whether or not they're for or whether or not they're against the policy. So what you see here is sort of this downward slope, right? This sort of downward sloping curve. And the coefficient, that beta that I showed you that I was trying to estimate before, here is negative. Because what that is saying is that as I move from being a non-superintendent to a superintendent, I reduce the odds that I'm against the policy. So a negative number for those betas is saying I'm reducing the odds. And the larger the number is, the more I'm reducing the odds, essentially. Okay? We could look at a similar picture and look at parents. Here again, I have four categories. I could be a parent who is against the policy, a parent who's for the policy, a parent who's not against the policy, who's for the policy, and a parent that's against the policy. And when we notice that there's a lot of parents that are against the policy still, we also notice that there's quite a few of non-parents who are for the policy. But what we notice here is that if you are a parent, there are only four parent signatures for the policy. This is across every school district. So this means whether you're a parent from a high-performing school district, a low-performing school district, a school district that has high kids that are in poverty, a school district that has high kids that are low kids in poverty, you are against the policy. This is very different than what we saw with regard to the superintendents. Right? So the weighting here is that if I put all of those parent signatures in a bowl, what are you going to guess? You're going to guess that that signature is going to be against the policy. And so we end up seeing sort of a positive sloping line here. And so our coefficient here is positive, and it's very strongly so, right? Because it's saying the odds, once I move from not being a parent to being a parent, are incredibly strongly against this. So I could go through, and I could do a logistic regression on all of the different sort of variables that I have here. I could think about who wrote in, and I could also think about what kind of districts there are from. But the final sort of issue that I have to think about when I'm getting to this more formal analysis is where is the variation that I have within this? And what's very interesting about this particular problem that we have is that we have variation at two levels, right? So we have variation at whether or not you're a parent, a citizen, a school board member, a superintendent. We also have variation about where all of those individuals live. Did they live in school districts that did make AYP or did not make AYP? Did they live in school districts with high poverty or low poverty? And what's interesting is that all of the individuals live in a school district. So there's kind of a hierarchy, right? You live and you are a particular, you have a particular relationship with the educational institution, and you live in a particular educational institution itself. And so what I want to study is not just how the variation is different between and across all of these different school districts. What do no AYP districts say in comparison to what high AYP or what high performing districts say? But I might also want to examine more closely what's going on within school districts. Or is there a difference if I look within the sort of no AYP districts as to how the actor type affects whether or not I'm for or against the policy. So because of that...
Can you remind me what the policy is that we're against?
Yes, it's the new graduation changes. Okay, so it's changing from the test, from doing the PSSAs to these end-of-course exams. And you have to pass every one of your student, has to pass every one in order to graduate.
And so most parents are against that shift.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so... we performed what's known as a hierarchical linear model, right? Remember I said that we had this hierarchy. People live within districts. That's why it's called a hierarchical linear model. And what you'll notice is that this individual level thing up here, it's just that same model that I showed you before, that logistic regression, right? And all of the variables that are involved in this one are all variables that are about who the individual is. That's a variable to say, I'm a school board member, I'm a superintendent, I'm this. This second level are all variables about the district itself. Did the district make AYP? Is it a high-performing district? Is it a small district as defined by enrollment? Does it have high numbers of underrepresented minorities? Okay. So just as before, I was trying to estimate those betas to see how that changes the odds. Now I'm not just going to estimate the betas, I'm also going to estimate these alphas to see how changing from a district that made AYP to not making AYP affects the odds of whether or not I am for or against the policy. Okay? So here's what we see, is we have sort of results. And remember, a negative beta or a negative alpha means that I'm more likely to be in favor of the policy, and a positive one means I'm more likely to be against the policy. So we have things both at the signature and at the document level. Remember, we have to analyze things at two units of analysis here. And here's what we notice. High-performing districts, regardless of whether it's a signature level or a document level analysis, are pretty much against the policy, right? This probably makes some sense. They're in a system right now that's working for them. They're performing well. Their students are graduating. They don't want to change the policy. However, districts where we have sort of high numbers of underrepresented minorities and districts that did not make AYP are much more likely to be against the policy. And what's very interesting is that the only group of people who are for the policy in any way at all are superintendents. Now, if we went back to this picture right here, if I had colored these according to whether or not the superintendent was in a high-performing district or a low-performing district, what this hierarchical linear model will tell me is that essentially all of the superintendents who are con are all from high-performing districts. All the superintendents that are pro are all from low-performing districts. And only by doing this hierarchical linear modeling can I determine that, right? All this tells me is that superintendents are 50-50. It doesn't tell me anything about how superintendents living within particular districts do anything for me. So again, once again, the analysis, sort of the choice of what analysis I do as a statistician affects the interpretation of the results that I have. So sort of some emerging themes that we've seen sort of at the level of the political participation is that high-performing districts are far more likely to participate, and there seems to be a huge alignment across it. They're all going in together. Superintendents, parents, school board members, employees, they're all saying, this is a bad idea, this new policy. Low-performing districts, however, are much less likely to participate. But of those that do participate, we see a non-alignment in the views across the actor types. Superintendents are a lot more likely to write in and say, this is a good idea. This gives more money to me that I can spend, that I can do. It equalizes how everybody has to do across the state, whereas non-superintendents, the parents that did write in from low-performing districts are also against the policy. The employees, the school board members, they're all saying, we don't think this is a good idea. And actually, if you look at the reasons why, you see sort of some interesting reasons that are different also across sort of the parents, which I can talk about if we have time for questions afterwards. But so it sort of asks an interesting question, or at least to me, it raises a really interesting question. Who's speaking on behalf of low-performing districts? Are we listening to the superintendents, or are we listening to the parents, the school board members, and the employees? Right? Because it's very clear, it doesn't matter who we listen to from the high-performing districts, they're all saying the same thing. But who are we listening to from the low-performing districts actually matters with regard to how we implement the policy. And sort of the final conclusion, I guess I would say, as a statistician, so what I think is really clear, and I think this gives us sort of an interesting example, is that how I collected, how we organize, how we analyze our data matters for the interpretation of the results. There's certain results that came out only because of how we collected, how we organized, and how we analyzed this data that otherwise we would see very differently. And I guess my final comment is actually a quote from John Tukey, sort of reminder of saying I think that being a statistician is the coolest because we get to kind of be most interdisciplinary. John Tukey sort of said it best, and he said the best thing about being a statistician is that you get to play in everybody's backyard. Thank you. Fred. We actually do. We include whether or not the district is a small district by enrollment or whether or not the district is a large district by enrollment. So we do actually include it in the more formal linear analysis. You're right, I don't do anything about it in these pictures, but I do have, you can see we actually do look, if you look at sort of who takes a stand, I did look at sort of how they do that by being very either small or large. We see that there's slightly more sort of participation from large districts, which is probably not all that surprising. There's more people within those districts, so they're more likely to participate. But they're not huge differences that we see, either by signature or by document, in fact. Any other questions? Well, I don't think you have no idea. I think that you have to kind of read the fine print well. So ultimately, they should have some notes in their plots and their charts and things that tell you something about sort of what the unit of analysis was, that tell you something about sort of how they collected their data, where it all went. And more, at least academic journals are sort of forcing individuals to do more of that and actually to put their data up and make it available to anybody so that anybody could say, well, I'm going to analyze it in this different way. How do I get something different? But it's true. You know, I mean, I want to sell a magazine, so I want to sort of make the most compelling case for the case I'm trying to make. But ultimately, you know, we need to be a little bit more careful about thinking about sort of how they collected, how they organized, and how they analyzed the data to understand that. Carr.
I would think that a question would be, why was this voted if everyone hated it so much? But that's politics. It's not statistics.
It is. So it is sort of interesting. The next step would be that there actually were changes made to the policy from the first iteration to the second. And I think the next sort of analysis that probably ought to be done, though this would be more difficult for a statistician to do, is sort of to look at and say, what changes were made? Why were those decisions made for those changes? So were the only changes made those that sort of the high-performing districts argued for? The low-performing districts, sort of how is it that modifications and changes to policies are made, and how much of that is influenced by political participation and citizen input? Yes.
Does the data show, or perhaps I should say, was the data collected in a way that it could show any variation between parents of high-performing students in low-performing districts versus low-performing students in high-performing districts?
That's a great question. We don't actually know that. I mean, in some sense, part of the reason that we have the data the way we do is that all we know from this data, because it's just letters that individuals wrote in, is what they chose to self-report. So the reason that we actually connected every individual to a district was in some sense to sort of use that as a proxy for telling us something about, you know, you're from a high-performing district. So that means you're more likely to be white. You're more likely to have high socioeconomic status. You're more like, you know, based on sort of things that we know are correlated with certain things, but there's no way to know anything about that. And it's a very interesting question and one I'd love to study more. Yes? So these are the reasons that we coded for the oppositions. And so you can sort of see that they're kind of across different things. The C3, penalizing students for systematic problems, it's better to support students earlier in their career. That reason was most often given by those in low-performing districts. So they're saying, we're not actually opposed to some sort of statewide sort of policies coming in. We just wish that you wouldn't do it once they're seniors. Why don't you actually do something to help support them so they're not low performing from the very beginning? So use those resources to invest in preschools or invest in you know, sort of other things. Those from high performing districts, a lot of them made the argument that there's a loss of local control. So they made this efficiency argument. They made this sort of thing to say, wait a second, we're doing well already, so why are you coming in and telling us what to do? We're making good choices, so you shouldn't be trying to take that away from us. And so you sort of see that there's there's big differences depending on which one of these things we go. Tim?
So if you had, say, 15 years.
So I think that's a really interesting question. I think on some level you could say that. I think what I find sort of interesting is that as a nation in some level, we talk about high-stakes testing, and we use it as sort of a noun. But I would argue in some sense it's a verb, right? Depending on which state or local place I live, high-stakes testing means something very different. So even in, for instance, this case, the first iteration of the policy was that if they fail, they don't graduate, period. And then, as I said, sort of a bunch of the high-performing parents came in and said, whoa, no way. So my kid's getting an A in this class, and then they don't pass this test, and now they don't graduate, and that means they can't go on to college or whatever in the workplace. So they changed the policy so that now it's actually worth a third of their grade. So it's still possible to fail this exam and graduate and pass. On the one hand, yes. I agree, it says something about governance. But on the other hand, I think we need to be a little bit more careful about looking more specifically at what the details and characteristics of the policies are and what particularly people are for and against within that policy. And that's why, even though this starts to give us that, and I didn't have time to do that today, obviously, but that's exactly what these kinds of things start to tell us about. And so looking at things like sort of why people are against what sort of differences they had. So, you know, what you see is sort of, you know, superintendents kind of said they were against the policy for the most part because they believe it harms particular groups, right? So they might argue, well, let's just make tests that sort of provide certain, you know, accommodations for groups is a different thing. That's very different, right, than sort of the parents who aren't saying it's harming some group but are saying, whoa, I'm losing all my local control. I want to be able to do this.
At the hour, I want to thank Lynn for